Well, a big thanks to Darren and the team for driving us through the afternoon. It is a Thursday, May 15th. I'm Shane Dawson, and you are listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7pm, Keane Tracy reacts to the destruction of Ireland men's sevens rugby and previews a make-or-break URC match for Munster tomorrow night. Greg Allen dials in from Quail Hollow on day one of the US PGA Championship, while Jeff Shepherd has the latest American football stories. Plus, we'll round up today's sports news headlines. If you want to have your say, you can text 51552, WhatsApp 087 187 9200, or find us on X at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Hello there, good evening. Welcome along to the show, welcome along to an hour of sport. Only one place to begin this evening, and that is by crossing live to Greg Allen at Quail Hollow on day one of the US PGA Championship. Greg, how has day one been for yourself?
Well, it's when you report on golf, you obviously like to see players playing well who are, you know, competing from Ireland, and it hasn't been one of those days, and this does happen, and you know, you load the expectation on our players, especially after what's happened in the last few weeks with Rory winning the Masters and Shane Lowry only just last Sunday finishing second in a PGA Tour event that he feels he should have won. And today, well, nobody really has fired on any cylinders worth talking about. So it hasn't gone terribly well for the four of the five Irish in action so far in round one. Rory McIlroy, he opened up with a couple of drives which were pulled to the left. That's been an issue with the driver for much of this round. And he did manage to birdie his first hole in spite of that poor drive down the first, but he bogeyed the next, and there's been just a general lack of sharpness in his game, not just his driving. So he's back on two over par now after 16 holes. He had a relatively easy par five, the seventh hole. He's starting, by the way, on the back nine, but he failed to birdie that, where he actually chipped the ball onto the edge of the green, just from the side of the green, and the ball came pretty much back down to his feet. And that's very untypical of McIlroy, and I'm talking about this general lack of sharpness. Perhaps that's understandable for a player who won the Masters 4.5 weeks ago. And obviously, 3 of those weeks have been basically celebrating. And he's just not looking as sharp as certainly he has looked for the first 3 to 4 months of the season. So McIlroy currently 2 over with 2 to play. Shane Lowry 2 over par after a round of 73. That actually included 2 huge putts, 1 on the 12th and 1 on the 13th. But all through the day, it was a struggle, apart from those kind of monster bolts from the blue, which were good bolts from the blue. He finished with a bogey in the last for a round of 73, 2 over par. Seamus Power, the best of the Irish, on 1 over par after a 72. That included an eagle 2 on his 5th hole, where he holed a putt across the green of around 45 feet. And Paddy Carrington shot a 2 over par 73. So we've got 3 Irish players on 2 over, 1 on 1 over, nobody in red, subpar figures. But there are plenty of players in subpar figures. So Stephen Jaeger, from Germany, is tied for the lead with Ryan Gerard of the United States, both on 5 under par. Luke Donald, the European Ryder Cup captain, has had an extraordinary day, 67. And a round, would you believe, without a bogey. He's only playing in his 4th tournament of the year. He hasn't made a cut. He's now in his late 40s. It's almost a part-time player because he puts so much into the Ryder Cup captaincy. But that was a stellar round for Luke Donald, the former world number one. And he's on 4 under par, 1 off the lead, tied with, among others, Ryan Fox, who was runner-up in the Irish Open in 2018 in Ballyliffin. Alex Smalley of the United States, he's in with a 67 as well, 4 under par. Alex Noren is in the group on 3 under par. And then you have a bit further down the field, Scotty Scheffler, 1 under par, the world number one. And obviously Rory McIlroy, not the only person on 2 over par, because Xander Schauffele, playing alongside McIlroy and Scheffler, is on 2 over par. And Brooks Koepka, the champion in Rochester in the US PGA Championship just 2 years ago, shot around a 75. So an absence of big names near the top of the leaderboard going well. Lots of players in the top 10 who we wouldn't necessarily be associating with possibly winning on Sunday. So even though Rory McIlroy is back on 2 over par, it might be a case of firing on a few jets tomorrow, shooting a 66 and putting himself into the picture.
Yeah, obviously very early days yet, Greg. Would you be confident that Rory can refocus?
I'm not so sure, because I think that this is not really anything down to anything other than sharpness. And sharpness might take a few more rounds to come, because when you achieve the you know the what he achieved in Augusta, which is the top of the mountain in terms of his career. He said it in the press conference yesterday that really what he achieved in Augusta might be the greatest achievement of his career, no matter what happens from here on. And if that is the case, it's almost understandable that he's not sharp, that he has decided to really enjoy what's happened. I'm not saying that's an excuse for not being sharp, but I think it's possibly a reason why we've seen mistakes, untypical mistakes, like on the 16th, which was his seventh hole of the day, he hacked out of rough and he couldn't get the ball on the green. Now, normally, you know, as deep as the rough is, he'll get the ball somewhere towards the green, but he completely undercooked it. And then that chip that I was speaking to you about 15 minutes ago, not getting the ball on the green from beside the green, that's very untypical of McIlroy. And I think if any part of your game shows a lack of sharpness, it's the short game. And his short game just doesn't look sharp at the moment. His entire game looks a little bit off. But maybe he'll turn it around tomorrow, because he is a player of such quality, such talent. But today, not really happening back on two over par.
Okay, and just on Shane, Greg, and I know you know Shane Lowry very well. Is there a fear that how last weekend played out and finished might stick on his mind, not only today, but might be playing on his mind throughout the weekend?
Yeah, I think you're making a very good point. We spoke to Shane yesterday in the preview, the preview press conference, or the short little, you know, gathering of Irish journalists, and I asked him, you know, literally, are you over, you know, what happened on Sunday, where, if people don't recall, he came very, very close to winning in Philadelphia on the PGA Tour in an elevated event, a signature event. He had a putt on the final green to possibly send it to a playoff. He missed that, and then he missed the one back. And, you know, he hasn't really looked as though he's up for this week as much as he might. And there is another reason for that. He's never, ever played well around Quail Hollow. It's one of the few courses that he speaks about without any great love. So you have the double whammy of the near miss on Sunday, which was very, very disappointing, because he is, you know, without a win on the PGA Tour since his Open Championship victory at Royal Portrush. That is a PGA Tour victory, incidentally, but all majors are. And he hasn't won since 2022. In any substantial tournament, and that was the PGA Championship in Wentworth. So there's a lot of talk about Shane, you know, when is he going to win? He's a world's top 10 player. To justify that type of ranking, he feels himself he needs to have a victory under his belt. And it's all kind of maybe bearing down that he didn't get it done last Sunday, and this is not the right course for him to come to after that disappointment, because he doesn't particularly like Quail Hollow, and he showed that today to some degree in his 2 over par 73.
Okay, great stuff, Greg Allen. Rory McIlroy will be back in the clubhouse by the time we check back in with Greg a little bit later on before 7 o'clock. Tom McKibben out on course at 7:31 p.m. to be precise. Just to round up, Rory McIlroy and Shane Lowry both 2 over. Seamus Power 1 over, and Park Harrington 2 over as well. Okay, we are turning our attention to rugby very shortly after the break, but first, some news headlines from today. In the League of Ireland, Cork City have announced the appointment of Gerard Nash as the club's new men's first team manager. The 38-year-old joined City following his spell as assistant manager of GAIS in Sweden. Prior to his move to Sweden, Nash held a number of coaching roles at Ipswich Town before working with the FAI and Aston Villa. As previously announced, Liam Kearney and Greg Yelverton will take charge of the team for tomorrow night's game away to St Pat's. Sticking with domestic football, RTE Television will show 6 fixtures from this season's Sports Direct Men's FAI Cup as part of a new 2-year broadcast agreement with the Football Association of Ireland for the competition. As part of the deal, 7 fixtures from the 2026 edition of the FAI Cup will also be broadcast on RTE. This season's coverage will begin in the third round, followed by 2 quarterfinals, both semi-finals and the final at the Aviva Stadium, which will take place on Sunday, November 9th. Meanwhile, TG Cahir announced the rights to broadcast the Women's FAI Cup semi-finals and final this year. In swimming, Olympic medalists Daniel Whiffen and Mona McSherry will be part of a 12-strong Irish contingent that will head to the World Aquatics Championships in Singapore from July 27 to August 3rd of this year. Along with the pair, fellow Olympians Ellen Walsh, Danielle Hill, Shane Ryan and Tom Fannin will also be competing during the 8 days of competition. The 12-strong contingent is completed by John Short, Evan Bailey, Ellie McCartney, Cormac Ryan, Owen Corby and Jack Casson. Okay, rugby next. Keane Tracy is standing by to reflect on the news of Ireland men's sevens rugby, well, being no more, and indeed a make or break match for Munster rugby tomorrow evening in Cork.
Game on. Rugby.
Now, Keane Tracy of the Irish Independent joins us to chat rugby, and it's been a busy, busy week of news in rugby, Keane Tracy. Lots to get through, and we have to preview a make or break match tomorrow night for Munster.
Rugby never sleeps, Shane. You know that as well.
This is rugby country.
Exactly.
Rugby
country's on shaky ground at the moment, anyway. But this is I don't know, tonight's enough for that conversation.
We've only an hour show, Keane. That could be to really dive into that. Let us begin then with reacting to the news of the decision to end the Irish men's rugby sevens programme, and it will leave players with a huge challenge in trying to maintain careers in the game, according to the CEO of Rugby Players Ireland, Simon Keogh. So let's hear from Simon Keogh now before we get your thoughts, Keane.
To be honest with you, I don't think there's a huge amount of surprise, particularly amongst the male playing group. We've kept them informed, I suppose, since January as the possibility that there's a threat on the programme. And ultimately, that's for a number of reasons. You know, we had a huge change in personnel following the Olympic cycle, and then we had a change in personnel, which culminated in, I suppose, in a lower positioning of our World Series, which then has an impact on funding. And then in addition to that, and it's probably the straw, is that there's a change in the world rugby competition structure, which ultimately means that halfway through the season, we have been relegated. So, if you look at that just in isolation, it's crazy to think in a competition that you could have relegation introduced halfway through a season. And that is ultimately has an impact on a number of things, including the finances. And, you know, where we are in Irish rugby, I suppose, evidenced by last year's losses of 18 million puts us in a pretty precarious position, and as a result, the Sevens programme has been sacrificed.
CEO of Rugby Players Ireland, Simon Keogh, speaking there on Radio 1's Morning Ireland. Add to that, Sevens captain, former Ireland Sevens captain, Billy Dardis, describing the decision as short-sighted and unbelievably deflating. Do you share their frustrations, Keane, or is this just a prudent financial decision by the IRFU?
Look, there's definitely two sides to look at this, Shane. We should definitely start with the human element. You've kind of touched on there, Billy Dardis' reaction. I see Terry Kennedy has come out very strong. Zach Ward, who was one of the standout players for Ireland for the last couple of years, who got a contract with Ulster. I think he called it a disgrace earlier today.
Sorry, on Terry Kennedy, you mentioned come out strong. Absolutely shocking from the IRFU. The way they've handled the whole situation is nothing short of a disgrace. Humphreys and Potts not even having the integrity to announce this properly, instead getting a media person to put up a post, and only because their hand was forced, as there was an article about to be published separately. He does go on to say, no mention of millions being paid to short-term contracts for overseas players, so disappointed for the current group of players. Disrespect that the IRFU have shown to Sport Ireland, the Irish Olympic Committee, after all their years of funding, utterly disgraceful. That's Terry Kennedy on Instagram. To be fair, that was just a personal statement. There's no right reply from the IRFU to that, and they've made their point clear, and it is from a financial review, just to give the balance to that. But you can see that there's players, former players, like when you say strong, so vehemently strong on this.
Yeah, and we should probably give a bit of context to who Terry Kennedy is for anyone who doesn't know. This guy in 2022 was the World Sevens Player of the Year, which if you had said that 10 years ago, Shane, that Ireland would have a World Sevens Player of the Year, no one would have believed you. Like, that shows how far Ireland Sevens had come, the respect that they had earned on the series. They made it to the last two Olympics in Tokyo and Paris. Last year, ahead of the Olympics, they finished second on the World Series. So they have been very competitive. This year has been more difficult because they've had a huge amount of lads who've retired, the likes of Billy Dardis, Terry Kennedy, Harry McNulty, who were really driving the programme over the last few years. And I think the writing was on the wall in terms of even trying to attract players to get into the programme. And that is the human element of this, Shane. Those guys who I mentioned, the Sevens programme started back up again in 2015. When David Nusafora and Anthony Eddy came over, the former IRFU head of performance director, and kind of made it his baby. But the players were being paid peanuts. It was remarkable what they were achieving, the amount of work that they were putting in, and very much off Broadway. Because, like, being honest, your average rugby fan wasn't really tuning in to the kind of monthly, bi-weekly World Series events. It was kind of when the Olympics rolled around and if they were doing well. And that's partly down to the time difference, Shane. And we'll get on to talk about the other side in terms of the actual financial side. But it was very hard to follow the Sevens because it's being played at the other side of the world. As I said, time difference. But the timing of the announcement has left so many players in the lurch now in terms of trying to secure their future. And the reality is they're going to find it extremely difficult to pick up contracts. Number one, because most clubs for next season have done their contracting. So it's very, very difficult to go into the market. Now, the rugby market has changed drastically in the last few years as well in terms of trying to get moves abroad. Squads are being trimmed right across the board. That includes Ireland as well in terms of the four provinces. It's not as easy to get in as it used to be. You look over in England and France, it's just not the same as what it was 5 or 6 years ago. Now, if you want to talk about the financial aspect, I suppose, Sevens doesn't make a lot of money slash money at all, Shane. In fact, it actually loses money as far as I'm aware. And look, and I know like the players probably don't want to hear that, and they've kind of criticised that the RFU have used the deficit in terms of last year, which was 18.4 million. But it is a bit of a misnomer because it's in a World Cup year, and off the back of World Cups, generally that costs an awful lot of money. So the argument against it would be that the Sevens programme doesn't cost a huge amount to run. The IRFU, I think, with the glaring line in their statement was that they no longer see it as a vehicle to produce 15s players, which is ultimately what makes the money for Irish rugby, is the men's 15s team.
And is that a fair comment, though? There's few players that do make the step from Sevens to 15s.
Look, we have examples and we can go through them. Like, you look at Hugo Keenan, went back and played at the Olympics last year. He came through the Olympics. You have the likes of Jimmy O'Brien, Will Connors, Shane Daly, Zach Ward, who I mentioned. But did Sevens make them the players who they are? I'm not sure, if I'm being honest. I think absolutely 100%, and the lads would say that themselves, that Sevens really did help them. But there's no way of knowing that if they didn't play Sevens, would they not have come through? So, look, David Nusafora has left, and like I said, when he came in, you know, he's an Australian, he was used to coming from a Sevens background, he got the Sevens programme up and running. Since he's left, David Humphreys has taken over, and clearly he doesn't see Sevens as being viable going forward. And if we're chatting again, Shane, this time next year, you wouldn't know, other nations could have pulled their Sevens programme as well, because Sevens is struggling across the world. They've changed the format, as Simon Keogh has kind of outlined there, which is a massive bone of contention for the players as well. It was put to me that it's like the Champions League in football deciding to change the format halfway through the competition. You know, it just wouldn't stand. So it's bitterly disappointing. I've been talking to a couple of the players, and you know, they made the point that the amount of work that they did to put Ireland on the map in Sevens, that, you know, they wanted to tell their kids in years to come that, oh, I represented Ireland at the Olympics, and no one will ever take that away from them. But ultimately now, it's a sport that no longer exists in this country for the men's Sevens. The women's programme, it should be mentioned, is going to continue, which is encouraging. But it's really sad and disappointing because of the amount of work that those guys who I've mentioned in particular put in to get this going. Because Sevens was around years ago, Shane, like back in the 70s, they played bits and pieces of it. It kind of came back again in the early 2000s. But when it became an Olympic sport, and that's a big part of this as well, because it being an Olympic sport, it's able to get funding from Sport Ireland, which is what made it more attractive to the IRFU. But look, David Humphreys has come in. The IRFU don't have an endless supply of money, which I'm sure they would say if they're here.
Well, they did note that in the statement, that it was with financial considerations paramount, given the backdrop of an 18 million euro deficit for the 2023-24 period. So, like, this is on David Humphreys, that he has to make some tough calls. And is this him dealing with a hospital pass from Nusafora in a way? Or is that unfair?
Like, you wouldn't know what people in the IRFU think in general. Look, we're not a Sevens country. I've really enjoyed watching the Sevens, but as someone who works in the media, we don't really cover it a whole pile because, again, people aren't watching it. A big reason I should have mentioned, Shane, why it doesn't make money is there's no TV deal. And you know, like I do, that TV money is where it's at in terms of sports. So there's no TV channel showing Sevens. There's just no money in it. So, of course, like, I would love to see the Sevens going, but I can understand where the IRFU were coming from. Like, my understanding is that a lot of the pot that they were using Sevens money for has gone towards the women's game, not just the Sevens game, but the 15s game. Like, the IRFU had been sleeping on the women's 15 game for the last number of years. Thankfully now, they look like they're on the up again. But again, a lot of money has gone towards that. You look at the contracts that's been handed out to 15s players, you look at the quality of coaches that they've got in, and ultimately, no matter what like anyone says, we're in Ireland always going to be a 15s country. We're just not a 7s country, and as harsh as that will be for the former players to hear, I think deep down that they'll know that as well, but I can completely understand their frustration and anger around it.
Are there concerns about the financial stability of the RFU? That's not something I thought I'd be posing as a question.
Yeah, like, what was it, 18.4 million, I think I mentioned, was the deficit. But I think, again, it's a bit of a misnomer because of how much money was pumped into the 2023 World Cup. Generally speaking, I think the RFU's finances are in good health, particularly compared to other nations across the water. Look at Wales and how much the Welsh Union are struggling. So if this means, Shane, that by pulling the men's sevens programme, that the future of the men's 15s is going to be safeguarded, it's probably worth that pain to get there. And again, I know that will be really harsh for some people to hear, but when the cash cow is the men's 15s game, you have to protect that at all costs, because like I said, the RFU aren't running off a bottomless pit here.
And there was very little else that could be sacrificed that would have that, I suppose, stature, really, in that regard. Is this going to be, perhaps, and I do want to get on to match action, as another stick for the naysayers to beat Leinster Rugby with, and the finances and overseas players and all of this? Because I know you have an article in the Indo basically stating that no one has actually set the record straight. Leo Cullen has alluded to there's a bit of misinformation out there and that the figures aren't correct. But now I know there is an attempt to close the gap from August of next year. So the four provinces will be responsible for 40% of the cost of national player contracts with funds generated to be invested in the player pathways of Connacht, Munster and Ulster. So that again is looking to change the narrative around the finances.
Yeah, I think Leinster need to come out and set the record straight, because my understanding is that they're very annoyed with some of the figures that have been thrown around in the French and the English media in particular. The week of the Northampton game a couple of weeks ago, 17 million was thrown around as Leinster's playing budget in one of the English newspapers. The French media have regularly made it out to be 16 million, which would be comfortably the biggest spending team in Europe if that figure was true. Now, my understanding is the figure is somewhere closer to between 10 and 11 million. But how are we to prove that unless someone comes out? So I wouldn't be surprised if Leinster do something in the near future in terms of coming out to try and clarify it, because I think they feel like they have an unfair reputation now. I've seen them being described as being like the Man City of rugby in terms of buy their way to success, but people are forgetting the amount of good work that they do in terms of the homegrown players that they produce. So it's become a stick to beat them with, particularly now since they've lost the Champions Cup semi-final. But we don't know for sure because the accounts aren't published. Obviously, Leinster's budget is significantly enhanced because the RFU centrally funded contract model, and from next season there's going to be 14 players in Ireland centrally contracted, and 11 of those are going to be Leinster, so essentially off their wage bill. So yeah, like you mentioned, the RFU, Shane, are bringing in the 40% to try and close the gap, but I think we were talking about this a few weeks ago when it was first announced. It's going to take a long time for that money to really make a difference, that it's going back into the pathways of Connacht, Munster and Ulster. But we're not talking huge money when you divide that between three over a long period of time.
Okay, match action this weekend. Importantly, tomorrow night, Munster against Benetton in what is make or break for Munster rugby. Munster interim coach Ian Costlow has picked the same starting team and the replacements bench from last week's 38-20 win against Ulster. Scrum half Craig Casey will make his 100th appearance for the province, while Jean Klein will play his 150th Munster game as the province look to secure their playoff and Champions Cup qualification spot. Would you be confident that Munster can secure Champions Cup rugby?
Cautiously optimistic, I think, yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned secure Champions Cup rugby, because that is what it is all about. Look, getting
a lot comes out to finances.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we're pretty much becoming a current affairs show here talking about the finances. But it is, Shane, like, that's the brass tacks of all this, pardon the pun. Munster, obviously, if they finish in the top eight, they get a playoff spot for the URC, and that's hugely important. But getting Champions Cup rugby for next season is what this is all about. Munster have a fixture lined up in Porky Cueve in December, which will be a big money maker for them. You'd imagine it'll definitely sell out, but it has to be a Champions Cup pool game. So if Munster were in the Challenge Cup, it's inconceivable, really, Shane. Munster have only been in the Challenge Cup once before, 2001 off the top. No, not 2001, later on. But they got there because they didn't emerge from the pool stages of the Heineken Cup as it was back then. So Munster have always qualified in the history of the competition for the Champions
Cup. Like Brazil in the World Cup.
Exactly, yeah. And look, you look at what Munster, the supporters bring. You look at La Rochelle and Bordeaux, the games that they had over there. Like, it's so, like, I'd say the tournament organisers are sitting uncomfortably as well, because they really want Munster in terms of the colour, the money that the fans spend. So it is a huge game. It's really pertinent that we're talking about finances and Munster. You know, they're like everyone else. The cash is tight down in Thomond Park at the moment. So they're going to Cork, obviously, tomorrow night, which I'd say when they set out the fixture, Shane, at the start of the season, they weren't anticipating, or certainly weren't hoping, that this game was going to be as important as it is, because Munster haven't played too many big games like this down in Musgrave Park.
I pose this question. I know you're from Munster as well, Cian. I said this to Neil Tracy. How does the Munster Roar in Limerick differ to the Munster Roar in Cork? Like, that kind of support in the two different stadiums.
Well, in fairness, Musgrave Park has been brilliant, both for Munster. It's been a great home for the Ireland women's team. It's been a great home for the Ireland 20s team, because the Cork public would argue that they're starved of rugby down there. That's what I mentioned about the game going to be in Porky Cueve. That's going to be a massive occasion, assuming it is Champions Cup pool game, because they're not going to have a Challenge Cup pool game down there for sure. But look, Thomond Park is ultimately Munster's home. And remember as well that it's a 4G pitch down in Cork as well, which throws up different sort of challenges. Munster don't play on that that regularly. And weirdly, it might, the fast track, I know Munster want to play quick rugby under Mike Prendergast, it's been brilliant, but so do Benetton as well. So that fast track in this hot weather should make it a cracking game. But this Benetton team, Shane, are very, very dangerous. They're level on points with Munster. It helps that it's an 8 o'clock kickoff. So the Stormers are playing Cardiff at 6 o'clock, which has huge relevance to that, to Munster's fate. So Munster could technically be out of the top eight by the time they kick off. Now, I would safely predict that the Stormers will beat Cardiff, particularly at home. So, yeah, it's going to be do or die for both of them, Shane. And Benetton, obviously, are level on points with Munster too. But it will probably help that Munster will know what they have to do. But it won't really change too much in terms of their mentality. They know they have to go out there and win.
OK, let's hear from Munster centre Tom Farrell ahead of the challenge tomorrow night.
We believe that the game this weekend is going to be another step up in intensity, and we're playing the guts of an international team, so we're fully aware of it. We spoke about just, it's essentially a test team coming to play. Like you said, their backline is littered with internationals, and there's some serious danger in the back three in particular, to the two national centres as well. We just talked about their phase play, their counter-attack, and their ability to keep the ball alive. So for us, it's just making sure we're squeaky clean in our defence and working in threes and fives, and just being able to shut them down. We're in a fortunate position that it is in our hands. So we're the only ones who can do that right now on Friday night. So we're at least in a lucky position to be able to put our game out there. We know the consequences that are there, but we haven't really focused on too much. We've literally focused on what we can control within our game. We feel if we do put that out on the pitch, that it will give us a really good shot of getting a victory on Friday. We genuinely haven't talked about any consequences or anything like that.
Just to mention, you can hear live radio coverage on RT Radio 1 Extra, which you can access on the RT Radio app, the RT website, or indeed on Serviu. Michael Corcoran will be joined by Donal Lenihan for that one. There is the emotional element as well. Keane Tracy also in the starting side. Peter O'Mahony, Stephen Archer, both making their final appearances in their native Cork. Well, it could be a final Munster appearance for Conor Murray if Munster failed to win and thus miss out on the playoffs. So I know they harnessed it last week. Can they do the same again?
Yeah, they need to be careful, I think, not to overdo that. I felt in the Six Nations, the Ireland team kind of paid a bit too much stock to players that they're leaving as well, and almost at times lost focus. So look, there's no doubt that they'll get, particularly Peter O'Mahony and Stephen Archer, who are both from Cork, they'll get a massive send-off. But they need not to, you know, make it too emotional, particularly after last weekend. I was down in Thomond Park, Shane, and it was a brilliant occasion when Peter O'Mahony scored that try. Genuinely, even though it wasn't full in Thomond Park, it was at 17,000-18,000 people. I haven't heard a roar like it in quite a while, and it was such a fitting moment for Peter O'Mahony to get the send-off. But if guys are, you know, overly emotional, like you could do something silly early on, get a red card, that could cost you. So they need to just stay focused, basically what Tom Farrell was saying. And what a signing, by the way, Tom Farrell has been, like, let go by Connacht last year at a bit of a crossroads in his career, and has come in and played in every Munster game this season. He's been exceptional. You touched on the back line that Bennett and have, and particularly the two centres, Tommaso Menichello and Ignacio Brex. They are outstanding, particularly Menichello. He's one of the best young players. I think he's 22. One of the best young players in world rugby at the moment, Shane. There was a strong talk that Ronan O'Gara was trying to sign Menichello for next season for La Rochelle. Now, Menichello still has a year left in his contract, and I think Benetton are going to dig their heels in and try and keep him for that one more year. But
is that what he was doing on the bus? Tapping him up on the phone?
Yeah, I saw that, right? The memes are already doing the rounds. But Menichello isn't going to be playing for, I would suggest, Benetton for many more years, because I think he is good enough to play in most teams in the world. So he is certainly one to watch out for. Most listeners will be well aware of him anyway, from England or from Italy in the Six Nations. So, like I mentioned, this is seriously good Benetton team that Munster have to be tuned in to make sure that they get the job done.
Okay, I'm aware, again, this is a very broad question, but you mentioned just Tom Farrell leaving Connacht. Connacht and Ulster, bit of player turnover announced today as well. Scott Fardy is leaving Connacht this season. Would you be concerned with the amount of turnover those two provinces, considering there won't be Champions Cup rugby as well there?
Yeah, they're both in a tricky enough situation. I suppose if we talk about Connacht first, Scott Fardy leaving is probably the worst kept secret in Irish rugby. Scott Fardy was an outstanding player, was brilliant for Leinster, brilliant for the Wallabies, but it's fair to say it has not worked out in Connacht over the last couple of years. Their defence has been appalling. I was going to actually mince my words, but I won't. It's been shocking, because their attack has been brilliant, as it has been, you know, a lot over the years. But you cannot leak tries with the rate that Connacht do. And it's not even just the number, Shane, which is obviously seriously damning. It's the kind of tries that they're conceding. Like, they're conceding, like, individual errors, systematic errors. So the whole thing just hasn't worked. And sometimes that happens, and it's been a tricky enough time, obviously, with Pete Wilkins leaving as head coach. He's actually gone to Benetton, speaking of Benetton, next season. It's great to see him obviously staying in the game.
He won't be there tomorrow.
He won't be there tomorrow, yeah. Next season, taking over as a tack coach, which is interesting, because he would have been far more renowned to be a defence coach. So, look, Connacht are currently in the market, obviously, for a replacement for Pete Wilkins. And my understanding is that they're looking for a head coach who will also do defence, rather than looking for two more coaches. Again, this goes back to finances.
Okay.
So I think they're currently in the market. Jared Payne is one name who's been linked. Obviously, the former Ireland centre. He's over in the Scarlets. At the moment, I'm not sure what his contract situation is in terms of would there need to be some sort of payout if that was to be a runner. But he's certainly the type of profile that they're looking at, a head coach who can coach defence as well. So not a lot of them around. I believe they're looking in the Australian market. They have Rob Saib is coming over as a tack coach, so maybe someone to complement him. But it's a tricky enough time for Connacht, because, you know, there's a lot of good work going on off the pitch. They're moving into their new Dexicom Stadium next season. They're trying to sell season tickets. But if you're a Connacht fan watching a lot of the rugby this season, I think you'd be quite concerned. And you could say the same, I think, Shane, for Ulster.
Okay. Well, just to mention Ulster as well, because you did mention Stormers Cardiff at 6 o'clock. Ulster away to Edinburgh 7:35 tomorrow, again before Munster against Benetton, 8 o'clock on Radio 1 Extra. Andrew Warwick and Kieran Treadwell will both make their final Ulster appearances in Friday's clash with Edinburgh at the Hive at 7:35. The pair are starting side for the province's final game of the regular season, where Richie Murphy has made four changes from last week's defeat to Munster. Treadwell, who is set to return to Harlequins this summer, will make his 179th Ulster appearance in the second row, joining captain Ian Henderson. Are you confident Ulster can do Munster a favour and defeat Edinburgh?
Oh, I wouldn't be, no.
Okay.
I absolutely wouldn't be. As I said, I was watching Ulster down in Thomond Park last week, and they were very good for most of the first half, but wow, they ran out of legs big time, particularly just after half time, and it was almost a bit of a metaphor for their season. I think Shane has just ran out of legs, and I would be concerned going forward. Look, Richie Murphy, it's his first full season in charge. I know a lot of Ulster fans have been deeply unimpressed by what they've seen, but I think he's earned the right to have a bit of time. He's got Mark Sexton coming in as attack coach, Johnny Sexton's brother. He would have worked with him at the Ireland under 20s. Willie Falloon only came in during this season as defence coach. But Connacht are trimming their squad next season. They are bringing in Jarno Augustis from Northampton. So he's an outstanding player. He's been called up actually today to the South African extended squad as well. I think Ulster will be hoping that he doesn't get into the South Africa squad too regular, because they want to have him as often as possible. But even like a penny for his thoughts, he could be ending this season as a Champions Cup winner with Northampton, and Ulster are not in the Champions Cup next season. So I'd say Ulster are making sure that the ink has been dry on that contract, Shane, and there's no get out clauses, but he'll make a difference to them. But generally Ulster are going with younger players, and as Richie Murphy touched on last week, there's going to be several growing pains to get those young guys to where they need to be. So I think Ulster could be in for another tricky season as well next year, unfortunately.
Okay. Saturday, Connacht away to Zebre, 5 o'clock. Leinster against Glasgow, bit of a dead rubber, 7:35. Leinster share the first place. Well, the Bulls are in second on 63 points, Glasgow in third on 59 points, so Glasgow will be looking to finish higher up in the table, I suppose, for a better draw in the playoffs. The Bulls are at home to Dragons at 2 o'clock that day. You mentioned South Africa, just to finish on a very sombre note actually, but news this morning that former South Africa winger Cornel Hendricks has died at the age of 37. South Africa Rugby said in a statement that Hendricks suffered a heart attack on Wednesday evening. Hendricks, who made his test debut against Wales in 2014 and won 12 caps for the Springboks, was diagnosed with a serious heart condition 10 years ago and retired from professional rugby. However, he did return to the game after receiving a second medical opinion and spent 5 seasons with the Pretoria-based Bulls, playing in the URC for several seasons. He also featured for a Springbok 15 against Munster and Porky Creeve back in 2022. A man that would be known to Irish rugby fans.
Yeah, for sure, because like you mentioned there, he had a remarkable recovery and got back playing, and fans would remember him playing for the Bulls. Like you've mentioned, Shane, he was playing up to a couple of years ago. Won a good few Springboks caps, was probably unlucky to be around at a time when South Africa were just producing exceptional wingers like by the bucket load. But I was watching a try that I saw on clip on Twitter earlier of a try he scored against New Zealand a few years ago, and it just reminded me actually of how good of a player he was. He had speed to burn. I've seen a good few tributes from former teammates. He seemed to be a very popular guy, and just very, very sad, really, isn't it?
Yeah, no, very much so. That is where we're going to have to leave our rugby conversation. As I mentioned, Munster Benetton tomorrow night, Radio 1 Extra, commentary from Michael Corcoran and Donal Lennon. You can access Radio 1 Extra on the RT Radio app, the RT website, or indeed on Serviu. For now, Keane Tracy, great chatting as always.
Game on.
Eye on America.
Now, Jeff Shepherd is on the line with his Eye on America and the latest American football news. Shep, how's the form?
Oh, everything is going great over here, Shane. You know, we talk about this. The NFL is the only league that I know of that makes a spectacle out of its schedule release. You know, I was watching it last night, and Rich Eisen on the NFL Network, he said, I'm just so excited about paperwork. You know, it's just so great.
Well, what we do know, the big news this side of the water, the Minnesota Vikings will become the first NFL team to play in three countries in one season during 2025.
Right.
A record 7 international matches will be played in 2025, and I do want to get your thoughts on that. However, the Vikings will play the Steelers in Dublin's Crow Park on September 28th. I saw Vikings head coach Kevin O'Connell, who definitely has to have some Irish ancestry, who is informing us that NFL fans and newcomers to the sport in Ireland will be seeing the best wide receiver on the planet in Justin Jefferson when his side play in Dublin in September. So is the Vikings, like, are they a big draw?
Oh, absolutely. And just a friendly reminder, Justin Jefferson, of course, played college at LSU, which is where I went. So it's important to note that. Look, you're going to have the Vikings and you're going to have the Steelers. You're going to have the purple and gold against the black and gold. It's going to look like Wexford against Kilkenny, right?
I love that analogy.
It's going to be fantastic. Thank you. Yeah. So look, I know my thing, Shane. So look, I think it's definitely the best receiver in the game in Justin Jefferson. And then, you know, the Steelers, look, I mean, we've been talking about this for the last couple of months. And, you know, there were all these different leaks yesterday about, you know, oh, this team's going to play this team in week one and kind of piecing things together. Well, the Vikings-Steelers matchup got announced, and I saw, you know, this was 5 hours before it was officially announced. And one of the TV stations in Pittsburgh was like, here's what you need to know if you're traveling to Dublin. I mean, the Steelers are all in. It is going to be a phenomenal crowd that comes over for that game. I think it's going to be, you know, just a treat to be there. And again, I mean, you know, we don't know. Will Aaron Rodgers be playing quarterback for the Steelers? We still don't know the answer to that question. But again, you're going to have the Vikings, Justin Jefferson, the Purple People leaders against the Steel Curtain of the Steelers, who, you know, with them and the Dallas Cowboys are easily the two biggest football fan bases in America. And you know, have spread internationally with the Rooneys being the ambassador during the Obama years. I mean, it's just it's the makings. It's going to be a really special, special weekend of football.
Yeah, I mentioned the Vikings would become the first team to play in three countries. So Dublin, America, and then they'll travel to London to face the Browns at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Like, the fact that it is a record seven international matches, and I know we've touched on it before, like the NFL are making a really strong effort here to spread the game, particularly this season.
Yes. And look, you know, we've talked before in the past about, you know, like the Jaguars would play two games in a row in London. Now you've got a team, you know, playing one weekend in Dublin and then the following weekend in London. They're testing out all these different scenarios for, you know, how do we ever, if we ever get to the point where we put a team, you know, based in London, how do we make this work, you know? And so you'll have the Vikings, you know, over there for a fortnight, I believe is how it's pronounced over there, right? So, so they're going to be able to train over there and you know, spend a couple of weeks over there as they get ready to play their two football games. And then you've got games in Germany, you've got a game in Spain. The season's going to kick off also a week one game in Brazil. So, you know, that's the second year in a row they've gone to South America. So, again, they're just continuing to expand the reach and the touch of this game, you know, across the globe.
Is it only a matter of time before they even go further afield? And I'm looking at maybe Australia, or there's a lot of sports going to Saudi Arabia. Now, no, there are caveats to that, but would the NFL perhaps explore those avenues?
I mean, look, they played two Major League Baseball games this season in Japan. The Cubs and the Dodgers played. Now, look, you've got multiple, you know, Japanese players on the Dodgers and one or two on the Cubs as well. So it was a pretty easy sell. But they were huge, huge turnout. You know, great marketing for the game. I mean, you know, baseball is huge in Japan. I'll be honest with you, I don't know exactly how big American football is in a place like that. But I think, I mean, they know the markets around the world and where things are possible or popular. I mean, you know, they had World League teams in Germany and in Barcelona, you know, when the World League was really alive and kicking. And so, I mean, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer to play in some of those places. They played in Munich, you know, the last couple of years. So, I mean, I think they're taking it cautiously and spreading it. It wouldn't surprise me, though, for them to play a game in Japan at some point. I mean, they've played college games in Japan before. Obviously, we've seen the success of the game that's played in, you know, Croke Park and in Dublin every year. That's kind of becoming a fixture on the American football calendar. So I think it's really only a matter of time as we see them, you know, continue to expand the game.
On the schedule itself then, so the road to Super Bowl 60 starts on Thursday, September 4th. Defending champions, Philadelphia Eagles, kicking off the new campaign. The season begins with a bang as the Kansas City Chiefs visit Brazil, as you mentioned, the following day, then host the Eagles in a Super Bowl rematch in week two. Mm-hmm. Looking at the fixtures, broadly speaking, the Chiefs still the biggest draw?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it seems like, you know, they know Travis Kelce's getting on in years, and there's only so much time left in this Taylor Swift window, right? So they're going to put the Chiefs on TV. I mean, look, there's you know, it's a 17-game regular season. All but the last week is already on the schedule. They determine the times of the last week of the season, you know, a couple of weeks before, depending on playoff matchups. So 16 games are scheduled for the Chiefs right now. 12 of them are in prime time or in like the national spotlight game. So, you know, they are maximizing what they can get out of the Kansas City Chiefs this year. Yes, they are a huge draw. And look, I mean, they're playing, you know, they're gonna play the Bills. They're gonna play the Eagles, as you mentioned. You know, they got their divisional games against the Chargers and the Broncos, which, you know, are gonna be, you know, which were playoff teams last year too. So yeah, I mean, wherever they go, the eyeballs go. And the NFL knows that. And so they're maximizing the number of eyeballs that are going to watch them. They're playing on Christmas, I believe, or they're playing on Thanksgiving night. So, you know, I mean, you know, you're going to have 30 million people watching them that day. So, yeah, it's they know what they're doing when it comes to making the schedule.
There are two more games on Christmas Day. Is it fair to say that the NFL have kind of taken that day over from the NBA?
Yeah, you know, when I was a kid, you know, and I'm in my mid-40s, when I was a kid, the NBA owned Christmas Day. They would play 2-3 games on Christmas Day, and it was just kind of always on in the background as you were opening presents and, you know, eating and doing whatever. And now, I mean, they still play games, but I mean, it's now you're gearing up for the two football games that they're going to be playing. They've got the Commanders are playing in one of them, you know, the surprise team that made it to the NFC Championship game last year. And so, I mean, they have definitely taken Christmas Day from the NBA with the popularity of the NFL.
Okay, final one for you. On a personal note, the Saints have any overseas trips? No, you're not going abroad. What's the story, Chef? What if you've been dealt a bum hand there?
I think the Saints must have a bunch of vampires on their team. I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I don't know what is going on. They play no primetime games. I mean, I guess there's no vampires on their team. I should put it that way, because they're playing all games during the day. That's what I meant to say. Sorry. So I screwed that up. But yeah, I mean, they are at 12 noon. They're going to have the worst broadcast team. It's going to be a bad year for the Saints. And you know what? You'll get to hear me complain about it for the next, 12 months.
Well, on that beautifully negative note, Jeff Shepherd, it's great chatting as always. We'll speak to you again next week. For now, Shep, thank you so much for joining us.
Game on.
Eye on America.
This is
2FM.
Now we can cross back to Quail Hollow, where Greg Allen is standing by. Rory McIlroy was 2 over par. We are hoping for a positive end to his round. However, Greg, it's gone from bad to worse for Rory.
Yeah, I think he shot a 74, 3 over par, just to say he bogeyed the final hole. I think really it's just been a case that he hasn't lost his game or anything like that, but he is just not sharp. And it's understandable to some degree that when you do as much celebrating as he's done over the last 4 weeks, that when you come to a major championship, it's distinct from coming to an ordinary PGA Tour event. The stakes are that much higher in a major. And, although he's been very relaxed here, I think he's aware as well that he wants to make a good defense, of his major's record by backing up the Masters win with at least a good performance here. So he went straight to the range after his round. He didn't speak to media, not yet anyway. That's not surprising, because he didn't hit very many fairways today. I counted 4 or 5. He started off with a pull into the rough on the left. On the first hole, he found a fairway bunker on the second. Both of them left. And then there were a fair few right misses as he tried to compensate for that. And that's called a two-way miss. And Rory's had this two-way miss before with the driver. And every golfer hates the two-way miss, because if the ball goes right and goes left on consecutive holes, you just don't know how to play the course safely, so to speak. You can't aim down the left-hand side and hope that the ball is always going to go right. If you've got a two-way miss, if you aim down the left, it could still go further left. So that's just in summary really what is happening today. There was other elements as well. He didn't hole a putt except on the 10th green of any significance, so he signed for a 74. So that's the situation with regard to Rory McIlroy. Shane Lowry, pretty much in the same boat, so to speak. Not sharp at all today, around a 2 over par 73. He did have a few highlights. He had back-to-back birdies on the back nine on the 12th and 13th, but with very long putts. On the 13th, it was 68 feet. But in the end, Lowry just had the bearing of a man who's somewhat deflated after coming so close to winning the Truist Championship in Philadelphia last weekend, had a chance all the way to the final green, and he just seems disappointed. And of course, he doesn't particularly like Quail Hollow, so there's a bit of a double whammy going on there. 2 over par 73 for Shane Lowry. Seamus Power, the best of the Irish, a 1 over par 72. He eagled the 5th hole that he played today, holding a putt of 40 feet across the green on the short par 4, but there was a ball in the water on the 7th, and his mixed bag added up to a round of 72. That's 1 over par, while Porter Carrington shot a 73, 2 over par. The world number 1, incidentally, Scotty Scheffler, he shot a round of 69, and typical of Scheffler, it wasn't going particularly well for him, but he birdied 2 of the last 3 holes, and suddenly he's not at all out of the picture, because he's on 2 under par, tied for 14th place. But that at the moment is quite a distance off the leader. But the leader is not a name that we would expect to be a man challenging for this title on Sunday, but who knows, of course. Ryan Gerrard, the American, has eagled the 15th, par the 16th, 7 under par, and he's got the lead on 7 under by 3 strokes over a group of players, which includes the 2 Ryder Cup captains for the matches at Bethpage this September. Keegan Bradley is on 4 under par with 1 hole to play, and also Luke Donald, the European captain, shot around a 67, a round without a bogey.
Great stuff. Greg Allen, you're a gentleman reporting live from the US PGA Championship at Quail Hollow Club there in Charlotte, North Carolina. That is all we have time for this evening. Big thanks to Ronan Lawler. Our producer this evening, Laura Lee Davis, was our broadcast coordinator. Game On is back tomorrow at 6 o'clock. We have Alan Cawley, Fergal Brennan on Association Football. We have Brendan Devaney chatting Gaelic football, Ryan O'Dwyer on the weekend hurling, and Jane Mangan chats racing. So from me and all of the Game On team, have a great evening. We'll chat to you again at 6. Do stay tuned, because after we check in with the news desk, Beto da Silva is up next with the new music show. Bye-bye.